This is episode 62 of the Fifth Estate Podcast, John Daly and the Art of Writing the Novel.
Hey there, folks. Neil Doing here. And you know, a lot of us get excited for summer because it means going on vacation or spending long days at the beach, maybe taking the kids to an amusement park. But you know what gets a burglar excited for summer? Knowing that you'll do all those things and leave your house empty. Summer's prime time for burglary, so now is the time to protect your home. For a limited time, you can take a whopping $100 off SimpliSafe's special summer package. This is SimpliSafe's biggest ever summer sale. It has everything you need to protect your home, an arsenal of security sensors to secure each door and window. Your SimpliSafe system comes with a panic button, a blaring extra siren, and a wireless connection to authorities and police dispatch. Your family, your home, and everything in it stays safe around the clock. With SimpliSafe, there are no long-term contracts, no installation costs, and no hidden fees. And 24/7 professional monitoring is just $14.99 a month. So this summer, see what SimpliSafe can do for your home. Get $100 off your summer security package at simplisafe.com/ricochet. Hurry, this offer ends soon. That's simplisafe.com/ricochet to get your $100 off. That's spelled SimpliSafe.com. SimpliSafe.com/ricochet for $100 off your purchase.
All right, it is time for another episode of the Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Doing. How are you, sir?
Jay, I'm doing great. How are you?
I am doing just fine, thank you. We took a week off.
We did.
But, you know, sometimes we need that. We need to be able to kind of recharge the batteries,
well,
so to speak.
We have lives, you know. I mean, people should understand that.
Yeah, things happen. So, but we're back. And now that we're back, we ask, of course, what we do. We always do. You know, here it is before we get up the show. We ask, you know, if you like this show, go out there, give us a rating on, you know, give us a rating on iTunes. Subscribe. Tell your friends to subscribe. You will not be disappointed.
Yeah, you know, we'd love to have some 5-star reviews on iTunes, but honestly, any place you come across our podcast, Stitcher or wherever, just go ahead and rate us however you can.
Yeah.
But we do appreciate those high ratings.
Yes, and those high ratings
keep us in front of potential future subscribers.
Exactly. And then of course, again, you know, when you subscribe, that helps as well. So, all right. So, you know, Neil, we've done a lot of shows where we've talked to people about, you know, the process, the things that they go through. You know, we had Kevin Williamson mm-hmm. on talking about, you know, what he does when he's writing, how he gets into the mindset of writing. And we've talked to reporters and the things that they do and, you know, just kind of laying out what people go through when they're doing something, particularly in a, you know, kind of creative field.
Yeah. And we've kind of focused a little bit, I would say, more on news writing, opinion writing, investigative journalism, that sort of thing. But, you know, we wanted to talk about creative writing because I don't know about you, Jay, but I enjoy reading books.
Oh, yeah, I do too. Unlike some new Fox News contributors, I actually think it's pretty good to read books.
Books are great, let me just say. And the people who write the books, also great.
Absolutely. Like our guest that we have here, Mr. John Daly. He is an author. He's also a writer for Bernard Goldberg's website, and he's also written for National Review. Who else have you written for, John?
I wrote for Paste Magazine for a while. You might be seeing me pretty soon in the Weekly Standard as well.
All right, the Weekly Standard. Very nice. Very nice.
That's great.
And John is the author of a series of kind of thrillers called the Sean Coleman Thriller Series. In fact, we're going to talk about his new book here at the towards the end of the show. It's coming out in October. But John, we appreciate you being on, and what we wanted to do was kind of go with, you know, like Neil was saying, the writers that we've had on have been, most of them, in fact, all of them, I think, have been like journalists. So it's been from that angle, not necessarily the, you know, kind of creative angle. And so in the fictional realm. And so that's where you reside in addition to the political commentary. So that's what we wanted to do, kind of get a sense of, you know, what goes into writing a novel and the process and how that all works. And you know, we know there's probably listeners out there who are like, I'd love to write a book, but I don't know where to get started. So take us back first, before we kind of get into the everyday process, take us back to how did you first get, this is not your first book that's come out. So how did you go about getting published the first time?
Right. This Broken Slate is my third book. My first book was From a Dead Sleep. That was published back in 2013, but I actually worked on it for quite some time before I ever, you know, gave it off, handed it to any publisher. It was one of those things where it was kind of a learning experience. You know, I had written mainly nonfiction and columns, you know, op-eds, that sort of thing. And I decided to try my hand at writing fiction, and it took a while, you know, to get the book. I was working full time as a software developer, and so this was all stuff I was doing in my spare time. So it took a few years, but the entire time I was working on From a Dead Sleep, I had never once thought about actually publishing it. It's just kind of, it was more of a personal challenge to see if I could actually do it. So the idea of getting it published really hadn't floated around in my mind very much at that point. But once I was done writing it, I finally let my wife read it, and she really enjoyed it. But, you know, she's biased, of course, but she thought it was really good, and she encouraged me to look into getting it published. And I really didn't know what to do, so I started with a little bit of research, and I sought some advice from kind of a friend of a friend who's a published author, and she told me it was very important that I find an agent. And I had read that advice a few other places. I mean, it makes sense. That's, you always, when you're talking about book publishing, you always hear about agents and how important they are in shopping your book around and that sort of thing. And around that time, I also sent out an email to an author named Tim Green. He's a, you might know him. I think he played for the Atlanta Falcons a few years back. But he used to write mysteries and thrillers kind of back in the early 2000s. And his books, which were, you know, very good, they're what first got me interested in the mystery, thriller, suspense genre, both as a reader and also as a writer. And they got me interested in trying to write a book. So I sent him an email, and I explained that he had been kind of an inspiration to me on my writing, and that I had written this manuscript. And I asked him if he had any advice for how someone like me, who's, you know, no one really knows, could go about getting it published. And to be honest, I wasn't expecting to hear back from him. He was a pretty big deal at the time. He's a New York Times bestselling author and a very busy guy. He hosted A Current Affair for a while when they did that reboot. So he was had his hands in a lot of different things. But to my surprise, he did write back. I heard from him probably about just 20 minutes after I sent him the email. And he gave me some really good information. He said that for people like him who are fairly well known, it's easier to get a book published. You know, it's the publishers know it's gonna be more likely to sell. But for someone like me who has yet to at the time make any kind of name for themselves, he recommended actually skipping the agent search altogether. He said that it's actually about as hard to find an agent as it is to write the book. And at the time, you know, I had just finished years of working on this book, and I'm thinking, man, I don't want to spend years of looking for an agent. So I was, part of me was kind of happy to hear that. But what he recommended was that I start sending out my manuscript to smaller independent publishers that accept unsolicited manuscripts, which means you can either just send them an email kind of with a summary of your book and to see if there's any interest there, or to actually just email them the full manuscript. And there are, you know, copyright laws that prevent, you know, I was a little worried about that when I first, you know, sending out the whole manuscript. You think, man, what if somebody actually takes this, puts a different name on it and sells it, you know, but there are laws that prevent that. So I started looking into some different publishers, started doing some research, kind of weeded out the ones that didn't seem particularly reputable or the ones that kind of facilitate more of a self-publishing sort of thing. I wanted to go with the traditional publisher, try that route first. So I did begin to send out my manuscript, and to my surprise, it really only took about 3 weeks before I heard back from one that was interested in taking it to print, which really surprised me because at the time, everything I had heard was that, you know, you could be sending this thing out for 2 years, 3 years before you start getting rejection replies.
Oh, know? Wow.
So that was great. And the publisher, they were only around about 2 or 3 years at the time. They were only putting out about 15 titles a year. And, you know, they were, I think I just caught them at the right time. They were on the rise, and they, you know, they had people, their employees and people in the managerial positions had worked for bigger publishers, but they were kind of, you know, starting this new publishing company, and they went with it. Everything kind of took off from there pretty quickly. It caught me off guard, and, I read over the paperwork, met with everybody there, and decided to move forward on with the process. And it's been a great relationship, actually.
That's awesome. So, John, talk to us a little bit about the process. You know, you've got an idea for a novel. You know, mm-hmm. Where does that idea come from in your case? The idea for Sean Coleman come from?
This might be the least original answer I could give you, but the not so much Sean Coleman, but the first scene of the book did actually come from a dream. At the time, I was actually working on another book that was my first attempt at fiction that I abandoned after a while. But that particular story had. It was sort of loosely based on a road trip that I had taken in college with a group of friends, and I tried to kind of add a thriller spin on it, and it didn't really work out. You know, it started out pretty well. It gave me some good practice for this type of writing, but I just felt that it really wasn't going anywhere, and right around that time, I did have a dream, this scene in my head where I'm watching from, you know, the bottom of this bridge, looking up at this bridge with a river going through it, and I witnessed a man who had... basically shot himself, committed suicide, fell into the river, and it was carried away. And much of the rest of the dream was me trying to convince people, friends and whatnot, that of what I had seen, but there was no evidence left behind to prove what I had seen, so nobody was believing me. And I thought, man, this would actually make a good premise for a book. You know, I created this character, Sean Coleman, who's, you know, I might get into him a little bit later, but he's sort of a different type of protagonist. He's kind of a rough character. But I wanted to build that that reasoning for why people he knew would have a harder time believing him based on his word, that sort of thing. But yeah, to me, it's really been the case with all three of the books I've written now, and even the fourth one I'm working on now. It's it kind of always starts with the opening scene. You know, it's important to catch the reader's interest right away, so. You want to introduce something that's fairly intense right off the bat, and then after the first scene plays out and many questions have been thrown out there to the reader, you can then build around that by developing the characters and laying the rest of the story, laying it out a little bit at a time.
Yeah, so, you know, you got to hook them, and then, mm-hmm. and so... Are you saying, like, do you have an idea, an overall, like, idea of how you want the story to go? Or did things just sort of emerge?
Kind of a little bit of both. I do have a general idea when I begin a story of where I want to take it and where I want to end up at. But at the same time, I also don't want to commit myself to that. Sometimes it's a better idea to come out of, you know, if a better idea comes out of nowhere and it kind of urges me into taking the story in a different direction, I don't want to ignore it. In some cases, it actually might add a whole different dimension or throw some curves in there that even I don't see coming, you know, when I'm writing it. And I think that it's something that will intrigue the reader. So some thought does go into deciding whether or not, you know, you're going to follow through with certain ideas. But in the end, it usually, in the case of all three of my books, they've kind of ended where I wanted them to, but they've kind of, in many cases, have strayed out in other directions between when the book first starts and when it ends.
What about when you're deciding upon like a length of some sort? I mean, is there a number that you have in mind, like a number of pages or a number of words, or you just kind of go with the flow and say, oh crap, I've got a 1,000-page book, or I've got only a 135-page book? I mean, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, it's not something I ever really think about. I mean, the first book was my biggest one. It was around 125,000 words, and that's a little long by today's standards. You know, certainly not unheard of. But my second two were closer to 85,000 and 90,000, and which is around where a lot of novels are. And I don't really think about that when I'm writing the book. I mean, there are times when you know, I think I have an idea of where I want to take it, and it's, you know, I can suddenly come up with this other idea that requires five chapters. So suddenly the book gets quite a bit longer, and I don't stress out a lot about it. I don't really box myself into trying to keep it at a certain page number or a certain number of words. And honestly, once you get to editing, a lot of times things change anyway. So, you know, certain things are going to come out, chapters are going to be shortened. So you're never quite, it's hard to kind of throw out a number and work toward it. So I don't even really bother.
Okay. Well, take us through, like, you know, obviously, I mean, I've seen people talk about, you know, when they're writing on Twitter, it's like, okay, I'm going to do, you know, X amount of pages today, or I'm going to write for 3 hours. I'm getting off Twitter. And what kind of mindset do you have to get into? Because I would imagine, you know, you pretty much got to, like, you got to close everything off if you're going to be writing a novel. So how do you, what's your routine to kind of get into that mode?
Well, ideally, I would love to just be able to get up in the morning and start writing, because that's usually when the best stuff comes out, I found. But, you know, I work from home and my wife doesn't. She leaves the house every morning. So I'm the one who makes breakfast for our kids and gets them off to school. And once I get home around 8:30 or so after that, that's kind of when I start getting into the writing zone. And it's really different because I do the columns, you know, the political columns for Bernie's site and other sites. And then some days I'll do the be working on a novel. And there is sort of a different regimen between the two. You know, when I'm working on a political column, I open the blinds and the window next to me. And it doesn't require quite as much focus. If I'm working on a book, however, I leave the blinds closed, kind of shut off the outside world. I can never have any sort of music playing, because that just completely distracts me, you know, when I'm writing, even the political stuff. But there is really, you know, a different mindset between the two types of writing. And then, you know, there's always that, those days when you get up and you really don't feel like writing. It's not so much a writer's block sort of issue, but it's just one of those things where you're just not in the zone. But usually you kind of, you know, and I'm sure, and I know write as well. Sometimes you just have to do it. You just have to begin writing, and suddenly that mood will come in and things will kind of come into gear, and then I'll suddenly be able to get a lot of work done. So it just got to be something you kind of, there's a discipline to it, I suppose.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, Jay and I have both done some writing. I haven't written anything longer than, I think, a thank you note in the last 12 months.
I thought you were okay.
No. It's sort of what you were saying, though. You wake up and you're just not in the writing zone. It's just, I haven't been in the writing zone for about a year. So it happens. It happens. So it does. It takes a little bit of, I would say, getting in the right headspace. So now, as you go along, you're chugging along on the book. How hard is it to finish, to say, this is done? One more brush stroke will ruin the Mona Lisa here, you know? So how hard is it to be satisfied?
Well, that's actually a great question. And the first book was the most, and that's, I hear this from a lot of people, but the first book is always the most difficult in this sense, because you kind of get into the bad habit of trying to write everything as a final draft. And so you kind of want to perfect everything as you're doing it, instead of writing it as a rough draft and going back and working on it, you know, kind of cleaning up the details and doing that thing. That's never really going to hurt the quality of your writing, but it does really slow the process down. I learned a lot during that first book. And when I wrote the second one, you know, I kind of had to force myself to write it as a first draft. And then go back later and you know, fix it up. And that certainly paid off in the end. But yeah, like you said, when you're writing toward the end, you know, there's a few times when I've written the books that I almost feel like certain chapters could end, but I want to sort of clean up some details, some questions that were thrown out earlier that might not have been answered. So, you know, there is always sort of that question of whether or not to to extend it a little bit longer than it needs to be, or you know, fill in some gaps. But yeah, it's tough. It's not something I worry about too much. You know, it's if at some point it just, there is sort of a feeling that kicks in that says, okay, you've covered all your bases. You left the reader feeling the way you wanted them to feel. Now's the time to end it.
Well, once you've ended it, once you've finished it, you say, I've got my story down. I've wrapped up all the loose ends. In come the editors, right? It's mm-hmm. the editing process. Now, this is quite painful for a writer. You've obviously, you know, become quite attached to this work of art that you've labored over. And then here comes some guy getting red ink all over it. So now, what is the editing process like for someone who's writing a novel?
Well, it's, you know, I might be different than most people. It's I mean, don't get me wrong. There are times when it is quite difficult, but I tend to have a lot of fun with it. I've worked with the same editor on all three of my books, and she's really good at what she does. We have a good working relationship. She's great at cleaning up the grammar and the point of view issues, and sometimes parts of the story itself. But that usually has more to do with the placement of scenes more than it does actually changing the story. We haven't really got into many arguments about changing crucial parts of the story or eliminating them, that sort of thing. You know, when I do the editing for a book, there's usually two rounds of editing that we go through, and it usually takes between 6 and 8 weeks. And you know, we do work well together, and I'm not one of those authors who is highly sensitive or has a big ego when it comes to their work. If the editor has a good idea, you know, or they have some ideas for how to make the story better, I'm always open ears to it. I want to make the book as good as I can make it.
And so that process, you know, when. So, I mean, will she say to you, like, obviously the grammar, but you said something about the structure, not so much changing the story, but will she say, hey, this would be better if it was over here? And then you kind of, you know.
That's absolutely right. There was, and this has actually happened, I think, with probably all three books. There are times when I introduce characters, you know, I do a lot of switching back and forth between characters, and there's scenes that she believes would be better placed sooner in the book, and so you know, we talk about it, and in many cases it makes sense to do that, so we move forward on that. There's been a few times where you know, we've removed small scenes altogether that were sort of, they were just kind of trivial and they didn't really contribute to the story, so those have come out. So yeah, it just kind of runs the spectrum. You know, we've never really had any major changes, but there's always sort of, you know, mild ones here and there.
So okay, so let's jump ahead more to kind of talking about now this book it's classified as a thriller. So mm-hmm. it's a Sean Coleman thriller. So kind of like, give us a background. You know, give us some of your influences, and then you know, in your view, what makes for a good page turning thriller? What kind of elements are needed, and what did you take away from the authors that you were inspired by and to put into your own books?
Well, I think you always have to start with a good opening scene. I think it's important to grab the reader's attention early. You always want to have characters that the reader really cares about and they invest in. And, you know, if they don't care about the characters, they're not going to care as much about the story. They want to see what happens. You don't want to let the reader get bored at all. Sometimes I'll make it a point too, if I have a chapter where there's not a whole lot going on, I'll make sure and make the next chapter, you know, have some action sequences in it, and perhaps in a different setting, that type of thing. So yeah, you always want to keep the reader engaged in it. You want to be dropping questions that they'll want to find out the answers to, and you'll always want to have a strong ending. That doesn't mean necessarily a happy ending, but it does mean something where you can, you know, when the reader's done, they feel as though they've just come to the end of a journey, and they're quite satisfied afterwards.
So John,
you know, what in your opinion makes for a thriller, and what classifies it into the thriller genre as opposed to, say, suspense or mystery or, you know, something that might have a lot of action? I can't, it's not necessarily just action that makes a thriller, but what is it? What is it? The pacing? What does a thriller?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. I mean, there's definite differences. Although my publisher actually markets my book sort of as all three: the mystery slash thriller slash suspense. They definitely do have in all those elements to them. One of the big differences between sort of a mystery book as opposed to a thriller. Thriller usually starts off with a bang, and it doesn't really let go very often. Mystery usually starts kind of slow and kind of winds into this story, to where the key premise of the book doesn't actually come for a few chapters, and a lot of it's sort of where there's the character development up front, and then they get more into the story, as opposed to, in the case of a thriller, a lot of times all the heavy stuff is right up front, and then the characters come in after that, and you begin to introduce them, but at the same time, you don't want to let them go either. You can want to keep going. You want to build the momentum. You don't want to lose the reader. And it's the same time, I feel, in my writing, I'm not big on labeling it as just one. I mean, it is called the Sean Coleman thriller series, but it does have those other elements into it. And I want to definitely incorporate those in all the books.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about your writing. How do you try to set yourself apart from other writers? You know, what do you think that you do differently from some of the other guys working in the field?
And John, sure. just to be a little more specific, like, so, you know, you've got the series. So, I mean, you know, Vince Flynn had Mitch Rapp, and, you know, Lawrence Block had Matthew Scudder. So there's, you're doing something similar. So So like what Neil's saying is, like, what do you kind of do to sit there and say, okay, it's fine to draw inspiration from somebody, but I want to kind of make mine, give it its own unique voice.
Sure. Well, a lot of it has to do with my protagonist. A lot of the books, you know, I've read have this, you know, the hero who's this really, you know, great looking guy with washboard abs and a girl on each arm, you know, and it's just sort of like a Captain America type, who's very intelligent, that sort of thing. Sean Coleman's quite a bit different. He's sort of, you know, he has a lot of personal flaws. He's not a great looking guy. He's not, particularly charming. He's had a lot of issues throughout his life. He's had a history with, alcoholism. In many ways, he's been his own worst enemy, and a big part of the Sean Coleman thriller series is there's a central theme of redemption, where these events that kind of play out and he gets drawn into give him a chance to redeem himself, not just to himself, but also to those whose lives he's made hard in the past. So there's a lot of things going on, and it's interesting because Sean does sort of evolve throughout the series, mostly in a positive direction, but not always. But he's just, I think, someone that people can relate to. You know, I hear from a lot of readers who say that, you know, these are real people in your book. I mean, are they based on real people? And in many cases, there are people in my life who I've stolen a few characteristics and stories from, and that sort of thing, to put into the book. But it's so much of it is just these. And Sean's not the only flawed character. Everybody, most of the main characters in my books, have issues and have things they're not particularly proud of, and that's part of it. Another thing that I would say makes me different is that I do switch point of views probably more than most authors do. It's although the series is named after one particular person, there's actually several key characters. There's a man named Gary Lumberg. He's the police chief of the town that he and Sean both live in. He's actually Sean's brother-in-law, who came in from Chicago. He was sort of the seasoned police detective out there, or a lieutenant, actually. And there's a lot of jealousy back and forth between the two, because Sean's always wanted to be, you know, this admired law enforcement officer, and it just didn't work out. And so I try to make these two about as opposite of each other as I can, even physically. So it's, you know, I try to get a lot of different perspectives. So I do switch point of views. Sometimes I'll even, not very often, but on occasion I'll jump into first person for a couple chapters when I'm looking through the point of view of sort of a bit character. And it kind of throws in a little dimension that you don't see a whole lot of. I see it from time to time, but I think it's, from what I hear, readers really enjoy it, and they kind of, it's sort of a guessing game sometimes when they start a chapter and it's from first person and they're thinking, wow, who is this now? This is an interesting, person. So yeah, there's a lot of different elements there. And sometimes that actually drives my editor a little bit nuts. They're sort of kind of conventional publishing wisdom is you don't want to switch around too much. And I have reined it back a little bit from the first novel where I do it quite a bit. But I do think it's, conventional wisdom says, you really shouldn't do it that much. But when I hear from readers, they always really appreciate it, and it gives them something different than what they've read, and they really enjoy it.
That's great. Yeah, it's funny you're describing that character with all those flaws, and I was like, are you sure you haven't met Neil Dewing before? Because, it's
wow.
I didn't want to say anything, but.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well,
Sean Colvin's. It's funny. There's a friend of mine who in many ways there are many who I grew up with, who many characteristics I are part of Sean Colvin, and he has yet to figure it out. My friend, this is actually
that's
sort
great.
And I'm like, maybe that's okay if he doesn't figure it out. I mean, it's. I'm kind of surprised he hasn't. There was one bit character I did in one of the books that, he's very small character. He's only in one chapter, but he's sort of a little bit flamboyant. And he was actually kind of based off of someone I knew, and that particular person, I knew they had bought the book, and like a day later texted me, "This is me, isn't it, you SOP?" And I was like, no, of course not.
let's talk about tell us about the new book. I mean, it comes out October 1st, and you've gotten some pretty good promotions here. Dana Perino spoke highly of it, and James Rosen. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's pretty cool. So, what kind of tell us about it a little bit.
Well, Dana's came actually pretty easy. I just sent her a few dog toys for Jasper.
Oh, there you go. Bribery.
No, I'm glad it is getting some good reviews, and that's great to see. I didn't really pursue a lot of those in the first two books. It got good reviews, Amazon and Goodreads and all that, but I didn't really do a whole lot of soliciting of people or sending out advanced copies. But I did this time, and I was actually surprised by the response that I got. I liked Terry Shepard. He's on Fox News from time to time, reality show host, but he really enjoyed it, and he kind of gave me a colorful blurb that's going to make it on the book when it comes out October 1st. But yeah, Broken Slate is the third book, as I mentioned, in the Sean Colvin thriller series. And the story ties back to much of what readers learned about Sean in the first two novels. One of the reasons that he is this unsavory character that I described is that his father deserted his family in a small rural mountain town in Colorado when he was just a child. And that loss kind of shaped the person that Sean went on to become as an adult. And the reason for the abandonment was always a mystery. Sean's mother was tight-lipped about it when they were young, and she later had a stroke, and it kind of kept the truth from ever coming out there. So in Broken Slate, Sean finally receives word after 30 years that his father has reemerged on the other side of the country, but as a murder victim. So the story follows Sean as he tries to piece together the past and fill in these three decades of missing blanks, and also get to the bottom of his father's murder.
It's fascinating. And, I'm really intrigued by the character of Sean Colvin. As you mentioned earlier, this is not like, your Scott Harveth, trained, Navy SEAL, Secret Service agent who can kill anyone operating, jump a motorcycle over a gorge or something like that. He's a bit of an everyman. He's actually, got a lot of very human struggles, So, yeah. How has Sean reacted? Like, has he been, placed into situations in these books where he can't really overcome the circumstances? Like, you know, is there like physical challenges or, you know, what does he get into?
Well, Sean's actually physically, he's actually much similar to Lee Child's character, Jack Reacher, where not the Tom Cruise,
not the Tom Cruise one,
but the actual book version where he's this big guy. Sean's about, you know, 6'5", over 200 pounds. He's actually a very large man. And I'd mentioned that his brother-in-law, Gary, I actually purposely put him at the sort of the inverse number at 5'6". You know, but just very small. But Sean's, he doesn't run into a lot of physical challenges, but a lot of it's personal struggle. He makes a lot of bad mistakes. And people see that the most in the first book. You know, the first book, the scene unfolds when Sean is woken up on the ground at the bottom of a hill that he had fallen down to while drunk, and he had passed out, he wakes up in a pool of his own vomit, basically, and that's sort of where the thing starts. So people that have followed the series from the beginning, they have seen an evolution, but at the same time, they kind of see Sean at times kind of fall back on his old self a little bit and pick himself back up. So yeah, it's definitely an ongoing struggle for him to be the person that he always wanted to be.
So in Broken Slate, you know, we've got a damaged protagonist here, a guy who's emotionally vulnerable, not always the strongest, and he's put in a situation where he learns that the dad who abandoned him is dead. Mm-hmm. He'll never get to have a conversation with his dad. Does that take a toll on him? Is that hard for him to cope?
It does, but it's interesting because he kind of slides between that and also some guilt issues, because there was, you know, there are times when he was younger where he kind of came to a point in his life where he wished his dad were dead. And he'd actually thought about this, you know, would he prefer his never learning the truth about what would happen to his dad and why he left, or would he rather have his father turn up dead somewhere and he'd have at least some sort of closure? But yeah, it's one of those things where he kind of battles back and forth between it and the book. His Sean's sister, who was also abandoned, she's been in all three books. She's more on the side of really wanted to find out the truth, and she's kind of a driving force between Sean when he's behind Sean when he strays, to kind of, you know, we gotta have some closure on this, you know. And there's a reason this his dad is, you know, the Sean Coleman thrillers take place primarily in the Colorado Mountains. You know, it's where I've grown up, and I feel like I do a pretty good job of describing it. But this is the first of the three books that takes place somewhere else in the country for the most part, and that's actually in South Carolina, Pawleys Island area, and where his father, you know, has turned up dead. So it's you know, there's his sister's kind of the driving force behind pushing him to be the one to go out there and take care of the matters and also get the answers on what they have questions about.
Well, that sounds great. John, thank you again for being on. We're going to wrap up here.
Sure.
But before you go, and we'll give you a chance, we'll let you, you know, I'll kind of plug the book again, tell people where they can find you. But in the meantime, we do have one final question to ask you. It is
I was warned about this.
Yes, it is the gotcha question.
The word is out. We may have to change the question.
Well, he doesn't know. He doesn't know. He knew there was a question coming. He doesn't know what the question is.
Well, we shall see. We shall see. So, John Daly, we do quiz all our guests on a matter of vital cultural importance, on which Jay and I vehemently disagree. In fact, the matter has come to blows in the past, and blood has been spilt. So we have resolved to let our guests arbitrate our disputes henceforth. And so we turn to you, John Daly, with this question. Which is better, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
Oh, see, I'm going to disappoint both of you, because I'm not a huge fan of either, to be honest. But I would, between those two, I would say I probably enjoy the Beatles more.
Mm. So you can tell by Neil's reaction. He's not very happy, but I am.
I prefer the Rolling Stones myself, and apparently no one else does.
Oh, really?
Yeah, pretty much getting creamed on this one. This is almost as bad as the Seinfeld question. Or the Sinatra question, or just about
everyone. Pretty much everyone. I think the only one that you came close was the last one. With what was the last one we did? Where the guy had, where you actually had to have it counted up?
Yeah, that was Seinfeld.
We was it Seinfeld? Okay.
I got on a streak and we let it run long.
Yeah, you got cocky and then it came back and turned on you.
Well, despite choosing the wrong band, I will still urge our readers to check out Broken Slate. When it's published on October 1st, and check out the rest of the Sean Coleman Thriller series by our guest author John Daly.
And you can find John on Twitter at John Daly, D A L Y, John Daly Books on Twitter. And you can pre-order if you go out to Amazon right now. You can pre-order Broken
Absolutely.
Slate.
Absolutely.
So yeah, you want to do that?
Do it.
Do it. And John, hey, you know, best of luck to you. So you had, you know, a nice, book launch and everything over there in Colorado. And
I did, yeah.
So that's great. And, you know, we wish you all success. And hopefully, we'll see you on a bestseller list at some point, and then we can bring you back here. Best-selling, New York Times best-selling author, John Daly. That's what we're going to, that's what we want.
And not the golfer for once. I think he is a New York Times bestseller.
Yeah, Amazon.
I put the A in there.
Yeah, I know. Amazon was having trouble with that. It was kind of like John Daly, and you'd see Broken Slate, and then it was like you'd see John Daly the golfer, and it was just like, okay, guys, you know, get your algorithms fixed here. So
I dress a little nicer.
That's true. John, thanks again for being on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. Yep. I appreciate it as well.
Thank you. All right, Neil. It's gonna do it.
All right, Jay.
That is another episode in the can.
Yes, so, a stellar listening experience
absolutely.
For everyone.
Well, as we get ready to part, we tell you, you know, we appreciate you going out to iTunes, leaving us a 5-star rating, leaving us a review, and telling everybody that you know in creation to subscribe to this podcast, and we really appreciate it. And I'm Jay Caruso for Neil Doing. That's going to do it for this episode of The Fifth Estate. We will see you. Did I say I'm Neil Doing?
No, or, you said four. You got
I said
it,
four Neil Doing. I'm Jay Caruso, and we will see you next time on The Fifth Estate.
Wrap it up, Caruso.